So I have a question for you, and the question is this. Have you ever emotionally and like spiritually, maybe psychologically, just bottomed out? Two of you? Really? Yeah, I'm bottomed out right now. I can't say, you know. Yeah, I mean, I've been there. I've been totally there. And then sometimes when you bottom out and you think, I have hit the absolute bottom of my life. No, you haven't. And then you go down a little bit further. I've been down that road before. And I can tell you just emotionally, having been there myself, like how you feel when you do this. And if you stop and back up and analyze like why your life is bottomed out, some of the time it's because of you. Like things that you did that you're thinking, what was I thinking about? My brain checked out on that one. I can't believe the decision that I made, etc. So when you bottom out, you feel things like loneliness. And you feel afraid. You get worried because you might think, well, God's hand of blessings off of me because of what I did. You might feel hopeless, and ultimately, you might feel useless. It's all that stuff the devil whispers in your ear after you make a lame decision, and your life falls apart, and you hit the bottom, and you're thinking, well, God's totally done with me because of that mistake. And that's the devil whispering in your ear. And it's that little raspy voice, you know, telling you, ah, you're a loser. And what's God telling you? No, I'm not done with you. David understood these feelings well because he had his share of making bad mistakes. He was a God after man's own heart, just not 24/7. And so we know by way of review, because it's been 3 weeks since I was up here again. I'm Marty, in case you forgot who I was. We were studying Samuel, and we studied last time about David's great decision when his life was falling apart. Instead of leaning on God, he thinks it's a great thing to get away from Saul and flee to what city? Were you here or are you all new today? Gath, yeah. Whose hometown was that? Goliath. So, I'm going to get Goliath's sword, which was massive. I'm going to strap it over my back, and I'm going to flee to Gath. And there's no way Saul will find me there. It's the safest place to go. This is a really lame decision. Again, I would say, have you ever done one of those? And you're like, what in the world was I thinking? So he goes there to hide from Saul. So just by way of review, like how long did it take for the people from Gath to realize that this Jew that just came in through the city gate with his massive sword was David? How long did it take him? Like instantly. Isn't that Goliath's sword? Like, whose back is it on? It's got to be David. He's the one that killed Goliath. I mean, so they usher him in before the king, Achish, you know, the king of Gath. And how did David defend himself? You remember, by way of review? He acted psycho. It's a Greek word. Psycho. Crazy. He's drooling on himself. He's scratching on doors. He's like an animal. And so what's the king do? He's like, I have a kingdom full of crazy people like this. I don't need one more. Get this guy out of here. So, yeah, he might have saved his life that day by acting crazy, but he had lost all self-respect acting like that. And he had totally jettisoned his faith, and you probably have done that with a decision that you made. And you thought it was a great decision, but you didn't ask God. He didn't. So he winds up in Gath. His life has fallen apart. He's there for some time. He's at a low point in his life, but he doesn't stay there. He doesn't wallow in self-pity. Oh, it's me. This terrible Saul's trying to kill me. My life's over. Now I'm just blown up by coming to Gath. What was I thinking? No, when he's in that particular city, we know from two psalms that he wrote about his experience that he had what we would call in New Testament language, a come to Jesus moment. You know what that is? You had one of those? It's where you realize, oh my gosh, I totally need the Lord. What was I thinking? So he's going to come clean. So Psalm 34 and Psalm 56 recount him coming back to God when he was in Gath and the process that he went through. So in Psalm 34, he's like on his knees before God, confessing, wow, what a sinner I am. Psalm 56, if you read it, it's like he gets up from his knees of confession and he's standing up and he's ready to go and do something for God. He has hope. And if you go back and read those, Psalm 34 and Psalm 56, because we have a church that pays attention to the details, it's just the kind of church we are, heavy on the intel. So if anybody just happens to read Psalm 34, and you read, in your English Bible, there's a superscription that you think is put in there by the editors and translators. The superscription in that psalm is really verse 1 of the Hebrew text. So it's inspired, it's of God. So in Psalm 34, it's talking about when David played the fool before Abimelech. But who's the king of Gath? Do you remember? His name was Achish. not Abimelech. So why the discrepancy? So a naysayer that hates the Bible is going to go, oh, look, it's you know, the Bible that doesn't know what it's talking about. The king of Gath was Achish over here. But it says in Psalm 34 that his name was Abimelech. Well, the only problem is that's not a problem, because Abimelech, Melech means king. Av is the word father. And it really translates into English, my father is the king. So Abimelech is a Philistine equivalent to Pharaoh. Do you understand? So Pharaoh is a title. It's not necessarily his name. So when it says Abimelech was the king that Saul played the fool before, it was really Achish, but his title was Abimelech. You follow? So now back to my sermon. You're probably going, what is he talking about? Okay, back, because thinking minds want to know. I was already approached after the last sermon, trust me, because we have that kind of church, which I think is fantastic. Just makes for longer sermons. Anyway, so David turns to God and realize that God is not finished with him. And it's the same thing that you need to do, is realize that you might have made a bad mistake in Gath, and you come clean, you confess your sin. So then what? Well, God wants to rebuild you, because you need rebuilding. And so we find in the first four verses how God's going to rebuild David. And it's very interesting how God goes about it, because his ways are not our ways, his thoughts are not our thoughts. So it says in verse 1, so David departed from there, Gath, and he escaped to the cave of Adullam. So if you had to flee from an enemy in the state of Virginia, any caves come to mind that you would want to run to? Well, we have access to a bunker. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about cave. So the last service, everybody in the last service is going to Luray Caverns. That's where Christians go in the time of emergency. We go to the Luray. Yeah. So David's like, everybody in Israel knows about the cave of Adullam. Massive cave. And I'm going to go hide out there. And he's by himself. He's by himself. So the cave of Adullam, it was in the hill country of Judah, so he's back on home turf. It's about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem, about 10 miles southeast of Gath. It's in the middle of nowhere, and he goes there by himself to hide in a cave. What's up with caves? Well, caves, there's no internet service. I'm just saying. So you wouldn't want to take your high school kids there, because they would freak out within 10 minutes. You can't do Instagram, can't do Facebook. It's a lonely place, no electricity, no running water. I don't know how you feel about dirt. There's a lot of dirt inside a cave, very dusty, dark, dank. I don't know how you feel about bugs. There's lots of bugs. And there's critters, like the kind of hide in the darkness of a cave. And it's just kind of spooky. And so he goes to a cave, and he's there by himself. And it's a very lonely place. And it's a great place for him to go, because God does his best work when he sends you to a cave. Now, just as a side note, just note to self, the Christian life is full of caves, like experiences where God put you in a cave. And he put you in a solitary place where you have to focus on him. When I was going through Greece the last 2 weeks, I don't even know how many Greek Orthodox monasteries I went into. I felt like a Greek monk or something. I went into so many of them. And they were always remote, up in mountainous locations, far removed from life of the city and everything. And once you finally got up there in the bus and went in, you're like, wow, beautiful gardens, running water. It's quiet. You can think, you can meditate. You could get alone. You could connect with God here. It's kind of like a cave. Caves like that. And so God wants to reshape. And so you might be looking at this passage right now going, I've made some lame decisions. It's cost me dearly. I've unintended consequences I did not even anticipate. I feel like my life's spinning out of control. And now God's got me in this like cave. And I'm all by myself, and that's the best place to be, because God's going to strip you down so he can use you greater. While Saul was there, he wrote two more psalms to talk about his experience in the cave. One is Psalm 57, one is Psalm 142. They both say similar things about his experience in the cave. Here's what he says in Psalm 57. He says, be gracious to me, O God, be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in thee. See that he's turned? He's not hiding in Gath anymore. He's like, Lord, I really need to take refuge in you. Until this destruction passes by, that's going to be Saul trying to kill him. It says, I will cry to the Most High God in verse 2, who accomplishes all things for me. That's hopeful. He's gone from being hopeless to being hopeful. So he writes about how God he sees now is going to accomplish his purposes in his life. So what was God's purpose on David's life? Pretty simple. What did the prophet tell him? You, little shepherd boy, are going to become what? King of Israel. Did it happen overnight? No. It took years. Because remember, God has to drive Saul out of David. through adverse experiences. And then he's got to drive further sin out of David in Gath and inside this cave. And so read the psalm sometime. It's a great psalm about the provision of God doing all things for him. He has great hope now, which is what God wants to give you in your cave experience. Hope. He's gone from being self-reliant to being God-dependent while he's in that cave. And so in verse 2, he says, God who accomplishes all things for me. True of David? Absolutely true of you. God has purposes for you. The devil's going to tell you, nah, he's done with you. That was the dumbest thing you could have ever done. And God's like, no, I'm not done. You just need to come back to me. So David's going to be the king. God's going to prepare him to be the king. It's just going to take years to shape and mold him. So it was a slow process. Now, we know from verse 1, it says he was in the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and all of his household heard of it, they went down there to him. We don't know how they found out. They got intel that David's hiding in the cave of Adullam. So mom, dad, and the brothers show up. This must have been an interesting scene. You know, you kind of picture them at the base of the cave. David, you in there? You know, and he finally comes out like, huh? Mom, dad, my brothers? How was that relationship with his brothers, by the way? Good, bad? Probably not optimal, remember? His brothers were not really on his side when he came to the battlefront that day when Goliath was mocking Israel, and he's like, I could take this guy on. And they're like, you need to go back home and shepherd the sheep. I mean, his brothers, hey, we're the warriors. Who are you? Now you see them, they're at the base of the cave coming to David that they know is God's anointed. So just as another side note, just another side sermon, do you have any components of your family that are like kind of jacked up? No, no, no. Are you being sarcastic? Well, I know you are. That's what you do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. She's very good on the front row with sarcasm. Are you not? Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, we'll go back to the question. Any parts of your family that are kind of messed up? You're kind of wondering, like, where'd they come from? What did they do? I can't believe what my brother did. I can't believe what my cousin did. I mean, I got it in my own family. It's like, who are these people? Why have they done this? How could you ever mend what's been jacked up? Well, what did David do to fix things in his family? He lived a life of valiant, courageous faith. And eventually, that courage rebuilt the relationship with his brothers. Just side sermon. So there's hope for your family. You just live a life of courageous faith, and God will eventually bless. That's what happened in his life. So his family shows up. And then I find verse 2 very, we're moving through this passage quickly. Breakneck speed. Verse 2. It says, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt, they must have lived in D.C., the car, the college, I mean, et cetera. Everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented with the current political atmosphere gathered to him, and he became captain over them. And how many of them were there? 400 people showed up. So you can imagine, he's in the middle of nowhere, he's in a cave, he's all alone, he's thinking God's done with him, he's confessing his sin to God. God's like going to rebuild his man. And so he starts to rebuild him first by sending him his mother, father, and his brothers. He's like, oh, this is unusual. And then all of a sudden, there's 10 guys, there's 40 guys, there's 50 guys, there's 100 guys. Next thing you know, there's 400 men there. They're like military age men there. And he starts looking at this going, you know what? This looks like an army. But it's a ragtag army. It's a motley crew. Now, the thing is, when you're in the cave and God's trying to rebuild you and do great things through your life, anticipate for him to send people to your life you never thought you would hang out with before. Because these are not the people David would have picked to like hang out with and make an army. Like if he would have made a list of, when I build a military as a king, what do I want my officers to be like? Character, you know, physical physique, what kind of shape do they need to be in? And, you know, all of a sudden here comes 400 men that David's like, why are you here? Well, I'm in debt. Man, I can't, you know, I just walked away from it. I left it to the bank, you know. Okay, great. Why are you here? I just don't like the current regime. You know, the king's all over the place. He's up, he's down, he's paranoid, he's psycho. He throws his spears at people like his son. I can't function under a despot. Oh, like that. Oh, okay. Why are you here? I'm just feeling emotions of distress. Oh, great. David must have went, huh? You know. So when I tell you, when God puts you in the cave, he strips you down and wants to rebuild you, anticipate him sending people to your life. Mark it well that you might think, I would have never known this kind of person before. But you're going to, and they're going to do great things for you. That's what happens to David. It says in verse 3 that David then went from Mizpah to Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me. He went where? Okay. He first went to Gath. Good idea, bad idea? Bad idea. We know that's a bad idea. Now he goes to Moab. Do you know anything about the Moabites? I mean, is it on your daily study venue? Friends of Israel, enemies of Israel. Enemies of Israel. He takes his parents there. Why in the world would he do that? We studied the book of Ruth last year. Remember that? Yeah, four of you were here. Five of you? Yeah, we studied Ruth. So who is David's great-grandmother? Ruth. Yeah, Ruth. She's from where? Moab. Everyone in Moab knows Ruth. And so he takes his parents, he takes them over there to protect his parents, because you should always care for your parents, especially in stressful situations. He takes them over there and gives them to the king and says, watch over my mom and dad until things settle down in Israel. He knows that the Moabites are his kinfolk. It's a southern term. Do you have kin? Do you have kinfolk? First time I went to South Carolina with my Liz, after 13 years of marriage, she only had three cousins. I don't even know all my cousins. And so for 2 weeks, people constantly coming in and out of my aunt's house all day long and night, taking plates of food, coming over. She's like, who are these people? Like, these are my kinfolk. You know, they'll take care of you. David goes to Moab. Why? He's got Jewish blood. He's got Moabite blood in his body. Hey, watch over my mom and dad. Then in verse 4, it says, as he's getting rebuilt, he then left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed there with him all the time that David was in the what? Stronghold. So he leaves Moab and goes to the stronghold. Wonder where that was. I will tell you what the word is in Hebrew, and you will probably know where this was. Are you ready? Are you ready? He took them to Masuda. Masuda. Sound familiar? Anybody? Anybody? Nobody? Sounds like Masada. Yeah, Masada. I've been there many times. What? Talk about a place you can defend. I mean, Herod turns it into a major mountain fortress. We're talking 1,200-foot cliffs that go almost straight up. There's only one access point before the Romans built the ramp around the back. The snake path that goes up. Easy to defend this with one bow and some arrows. And so it is quite possible that he went there. Because he's coming back from Moab, he'd go right by Masada, and he takes his 400 soldiers there. It says, hey, talk about a place you can defend. 400 of us up there, there's no way Saul can get to us. So David's probably thinking in his mind in this fortress location, man, God's using me, and there's no way my enemy can take me out. This is the best place to be. But God always does things differently. You know what I'm saying? It's like when you're playing ball, and you're expecting the next pitch to be a fastball. And the pitcher throws you like a changeup. That's God. God is the God of changeups. And that's going to be verse 5. God's going to give him a prophet. The guy's name is Gad. He's going to give him a word of revelation. He's going to go from rebuilding him to a word of revelation. It says, the prophet Gad said to David, hey, don't stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah. Of which David could have said, what? Like, what are you talking about? I'm in a great strategic location. What did David do? He listened to the prophet. So David departed and he went where? To the forest of Herith. I don't know where that is. I just know it's a forest. Now, I do not know that the word for forest can be translated from the Hebrew thicket. So when you think of a thicket, what are you thinking? Heavy, dense brush, easy to hide an army in a thicket. But for me, if I have the choice to hide my soldiers in a mountain fortress that only has one access point, or having my 400 guys out in the open in the forest, I'm choosing the mountain fortress. See, God doesn't do things like we would do. And so he sends him there. And so he's teaching us that when you rebel against God and then you confess and then God puts you in a cave to strip you down and then he begins to bless you with other people who begin to move you forward to accomplish his goal, expect for God to reach down and give you a word, like a word of what he wants you to do, point you in a direction. Just by way of review, remember that I was the guy when I told God after 19 years at my last church that I feel like you want me to move? You know, I need a word. So I will only go to West Coast states. I was that guy. You ever prayed a dumb prayer? I was that guy. I'll go to Washington State, Oregon, maybe Oregon, California, Arizona, Nevada. Right there, God. I'll go there. What God do? She's like, dude, it's East Coast for you. You know, and so I've been in that cave before. I read Swindoll's book on David back in 2009 or 2008 with my small group at my house at my last church. And we were reading through David. And I was going through that book again this week, many years later. And I had written in the book David's cave experience and what God did with him. And I wrote in there because I was in a cave at the time. Feeling I was alone, God was done with me, my ministry was over, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote in there the prayers that I prayed in the margins of that book. And I said, God, would you please do this for me that you did for David? And then I dated it, November the 9th, 2008. I told Liz this week, it's kind of chilling, kind of exciting. When you look back and you see, man, I've been in that cave, and God answered in a profound way because he gave me a word. His word was East Coast. And so I said, okay, Lord, that's what you want me to do. You know, that's what you want. Then I shall go there. And then God blessed me with friends that I never thought I would have before. Like you. I didn't know people from New York. I didn't meet people from New Jersey. I didn't know anything about Philadelphia or cheesesteak sandwiches or I didn't know any of this stuff. But Christians have helped educate me. But God gives you whole new friends to show you what he wants you to do, just to be obedient and go, and he'll bless you. But also realize that when God gives you a word, never forget your adversary, the devil, okay? Because don't think he's all excited with you moving on with God and doing greater things. He's very active. And so what we find in verses 6 to 19 is what I would call the ruination. It's the devil through Saul is going to try to ruin David. Big time. It says in verse 8, Saul heard that David and his men, because he had spies, were with him and had been discovered in Masada. And now David was sitting in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree on the height, and the height of his spear was in his hand. And all of his servants were standing around, all his bodyguards, everybody's with him. He's in a power position. He's on a hill. He's under a tamarisk tree. And he's thinking he's all that in a bag of chips. And I'm going to get David. I totally know where he is. He's going down, etc. But he's sitting under what kind of tree? A tamarisk tree. You might read this and go, that's totally insignificant. Move on. No, you shouldn't do that. Because a tamarisk tree is very interesting. A tamarisk tree grows in arid locations. It doesn't need a whole lot of water. And it has a tap root that averages 100 feet deep. This thing's not blowing over in a Virginia wind. You're not blowing this tree over. It can handle the elements. It can handle the heat. It can handle the lack of water because its roots are so deep down into the ground. And Saul is sitting under this tree. Now, this is interesting. Saul is going to move to kill the priest of Israel who would dare help David. He's going to bring demonic activity to the nation to destroy the priesthood. And God's like, and you're sitting under a tamarisk tree? He's telling Saul, it's kind of a metaphor. You think you're going to destroy David, my chosen king? But no, he's resilient like that tree. His roots are deep into me. Says Saul said to his servants who stood around him, here now, Benjamites, all my buddies, because Saul's a Benjamite, all the people around him are Benjamite. Bad leaders tend to surround themselves with people of like mind that, you know, kind of support the craziness. He says, will the son of Jesse also give to you fields and vineyards? I mean, he tells his people, I mean, is David, if he became the king, going to bless you, you know, with giving you stuff when you scratch my back, I scratch your back? Is he going to do that for you? No, he won't do that for you. He says, will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? No, he's not going to do that for you. Only I, great Saul, can do that for you. So David can't bless you. So he has a messed up leadership style. If you do things for him, he will advance you. David has loyalty from his people on a whole different level. Than what Saul had. Saul is a paranoid man who's crazy. It says in verse 7, he said, no one, he won't bless you like I will bless you. And then he flips because he's paranoid in verse 8, and he says to the same people, all of you have conspired against me. Translated, I know all of you in this room are out to get me. He says, so that there's no one like in this room who discloses under this tree who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse.
I can't trust you people. He says, and there is none of you who is sorry for me to me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant David against me to lie in ambush as it is this day. It's terrible. All you people are supposed to be with me. I know you're against me. He's paranoid. Nothing worse than a paranoid leader with power. What is a paranoid person like? They distort facts. They are irrational in their thinking. They are always convinced that everybody is out to get them. When I went to seminary back in 1981 to Dallas Seminary, I had to take a Minnesota multiphasic inventory test, the psychological test, because I don't want to make before you don't want crazy pastors at seminary, right? So I took this test, and I went to the University of Pacific, and I went at night with the professor who was head of that program at the university, and I told him what I was doing, so he gave me the test. And I double majored in college, but I was going to triple major in psychology, but I needed one more class in psychology to triple major, and I got tired my senior year, and so I didn't take the last psychology class. Translated, I knew a lot about psychology, right? So I'm taking this test, and I see all the thread questions. Schizophrenia, paranoid questions. And I was in a room of one-way mirrors for observation. Okay, I'm surrounded in this. I'm by myself at night in this huge building. And I'm in this room of these 600 questions, and I'm going, that's a paranoid question. When you're walking down the street at night, do you feel like somebody's walking behind you, and you turn around and there's no one there? When you get into your vehicle, do you feel like someone might be in the back seat, so you look over your shoulder to see if it's empty? You're going, I do that all the time. Okay, well, then you're paranoid. You're paranoid. You know, and I'm sitting there taking this test, and then I start laughing out loud. Me? You know, I'm 21, 22 years old. I start laughing in this room. I'm laughing. I'm like, I totally see what you're doing. Like, these are paranoid questions. These are one-way mirrors. Someone is probably looking at me right now. I became paranoid. Anyway, back to my sermon. So Saul is totally paranoid. So Doeg, remember him? The head shepherd, from Saul. So Doeg was there when David fled to the high priest and asked for food and a weapon. And he saw all that. And so Doeg is now with Saul. It says in verse 9, Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, answered and said to him, hey, I've got some good intel. I saw the son of Jesse, David, coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. The high priest is who this is. He said, I was there. Verse 10. And he said, let me tell you what happened there when David was with the high priest. The high priest, inquired of the Lord for him. He gave him provisions, food, table of showbread bread, and he gave him the sword of the Goliath. So what part of that is true and what part is false? The first part is false. See, this is what evil people do. They use disinformation to destroy people. So he uses a lie to set up the high priest to kill the high priest. Because he's Doeg the Edomite. He hates Jews. He's an anti-Semite. So he tells a lie. Oh, the high priest used the Urim and the Thummim stones to determine the will of God for David. Now, the Urim and the Thummim stones behind the breastplate of the high priest in the ephod were two stones that would glow yes or no. I've always wanted these in my repertoire. Wouldn't you want them? God, do you want me to go to D.C. or not? Let the stone glow. Yes, you're going. Yeah. Or no, you're staying in California. Yeah. David didn't do that. He did ask for food, and he did ask for a weapon, but Doeg lies. Verse 11 said, the king listened to him, and he said, he summoned to Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's household, and the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. He's like, if you guys have sided with David, I need to hear from you, high priest, like what went down. We need to get to the bottom of this if you become traitors. And Saul said in verse 12, listen now. Notice what he says there in verse 12. Listen now, son of Ahitub. And he answered and he said, here I am, my Lord. This is the high priest of Israel. High priest. What's his name? Ahimelech. What did Saul call him? Son of Ahitub. What did Saul not do? He didn't use his name. See what he did? He didn't even use his name. He disrespects the high priest. He says, I don't like you, high priest. And you're siding with David, and he wants to be the next king, and you're helping him. I'm not even going to say your name. He doesn't even use his name. Unbelievable. Verse 13, Saul then said to him, why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me? I'm paranoid and I think you're all against me. Why'd you do that? In that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him. So he's already bought the lie that he had used the Urim and the Thummim, which he hadn't. That he should rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day. Isn't this interesting? Who was lying in ambush to kill who? Saul is lying in ambush to kill David. Not David lying in ambush to kill. It's the other way around. See, the despotic leader, the totalitarian leader, flips everything around. They're always the victim when they're the victimizer. That's Saul. Verse 14, Elimelech is going to give his answer in this kangaroo court. Now, what happens in the kangaroo court? No justice. Why? Facts don't matter. It's already been made up that you're guilty, and they're gonna nail you anyway. That's what's going to happen in this court. Verse 14, Elimelech answered and said to the king, who among all of your servants is as faithful as David? Even the king's son-in-law. He's your son-in-law. He married your daughter. He's captain over your guard, and he's honored in your house. I mean, you think he's out to get you? Consider the facts. He is so loyal to you, Saul. You know, wake up and check it out. Facts aren't going to matter to him. Remember, it's a kangaroo court. He wants to kill David because he wants to hang on to power. Verse 15, the high priest says, did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Translated, did I use the Urim and the Thummim to find out God's will for him? Huh? He says, far be it from me. I didn't do that. Don't let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of his household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. I don't even know what you're talking about. I mean, David's out to kill you, and I was a part of this as a huge conspiracy. That didn't happen. Saul should have said, Ahimelech, high priest, thank you so much for telling us exactly what happened. Doeg, you didn't give me the full thing. Because remember, Doeg left out a very, very important point. He did not tell the king, oh yeah, by the way, David told the high priest that he was there on a secret mission for you. See? He didn't tell him that because he wants to paint the high priest in a bad light. Verse 16, the king said, because of your being a traitor, I'm convinced of it, you shall surely die, Ahimelech. Oh, not just you. Let's throw in your entire household. Brutal, absolutely brutal. So it says in verse 17, the king said to his guards who were attending unto him, turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, because they knew that he was fleeing. They didn't reveal it to me. But his servants of the king, that finally had some backbone, were not willing to put their hands out to attack the priest of the Lord. He's telling them, you guys around me with all the weapons, go kill all the priests. And those men finally said, you are crazy. You're crazy. There's a line you don't cross, and that's killing priests. See, that's what the devil wants to happen, wipe out the priests. And so he can't get his men around him to kill the priests, rightly so. Verse 18, then the king turned and said to Doeg, you, non-Israelite, you turn and attack the priest. What'd he do? What'd he do? Doeg, the Edomite, turned around and attacked the priest. How many did he kill? 85 of them. I mean, he almost eliminates the priesthood. He wipes them out. And that's not all that he did in his anti-Semitic behavior. Verse 19 says that he struck Nob. So he left the tamarisk tree, travels down to Nob, where the priests were from and all their families. And he goes to the city of the priest. He strikes them down with the edges of the sword. Men, women, children, infants, oxen, sheep, killed them all. This guy is the epitome of the devil. This is anti-Semitic behavior. This is Antichrist behavior. The point being, when God puts you in that cave to rebuild you, and he begins to rebuild you and sends people to your life to help you go do greater things for him, and you start seeing light in your life, you start having hope and joy, and things start looking great, do not forget your adversary, the devil. He's always working to destroy, but don't be afraid of him, because who's with you? The Lord is with you, as he was with David. And we read about God's great actions in the last three verses. I call it the rescue. The rescue? It says in verse 20, but one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. One priest wasn't eliminated. The devil always makes mistakes. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, I knew on the day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul what happened. I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. I can bear the responsibility of this. Then he tells the high priest, stay with me, don't be afraid. For he who seeks my life seeks your life, but you're safe with me. David says to Abiathar, you're the last standing priest. David now has two things in his life the king needs. He has a prophet and he has the high priest. The very things that Saul does not have because God took the kingdom away from him, God gives them to David to build him up and do great things with him. Remember Psalm 57, verse 2. David cried in the cave, I will cry to God the Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. Even in the tragedy of the losing of the priest, God said, oh no, the devil can't trump my work. I got one priest left, and that priest is going to become the high priest when David becomes the king. God's not through with you. Even if your life was whittled down by tragedy, God's like, no, I will accomplish what needs to be accomplished. You just follow me. So when you think about this passage, this motif is what surfaces in my mind. God fulfills his purposes. Despite fierce opposition, I've been there. Who does he fulfill it through? Broken people, desperate people, and people that repent. God says, I can use you to do great things. That's you. Let it be you. And watch God do great things. This has been like a worship service of 70s flashback. It's been amazing, hasn't it? Yeah, I'm like, really? Soon and very soon we're going to see the king? Yeah, we're going to end with a song that's Just As I Am. It's the song that I got saved on in 1969. And it's like five or six verses. I was in the first seat right in front of the podium when the pastor came down. I strategically placed myself so I didn't have to walk down a long aisle. I sat right there. So when that song was sung, it got down to like the fifth or sixth verse. I just stood up and walked and stood before Dr. Lind. And he wrapped his big arms around me. He was a Navy captain, chaplain. Wrapped his arm big around me and said, welcome to the family of God party. How did I come? Just as I am. That's how God takes you. Let's sing it to him. You can stand and sing.